Welcome everybody to the Chasing High Yield panel here at the Dissecting ETFs conference. Pleasure to be here. My name is Tim Seymour. I'm gonna be the moderator, and I'm gonna try to keep the ball moving with a team of four panelists that really have a lot of experience in this entire both ETF sphere, but again, in the sphere of high yield. And just to put a little bit more clarity, I think, on the focus of the panel. So high yield sounds like we could be talking about BB- and lower, or we could be talking about debt exclusively. In fact, I think to clarify, the goal here is to really expose you to opportunities in the ETF space that really about yield income. And so we have a couple guys here who have a heavy track record in MLPs. We're gonna talk about converts. We're gonna talk about dividend-paying stocks. We're gonna talk about different strategies, I think, to counterbalance a world where people think that rates are too low or that yields are too low. So let me quickly jump off. Again, I'm Tim Seymour. My background in the world of high yield comes from an emerging markets perspective. I've spent a lot of time in the macro EM debt world, and certainly have a view on where risk versus yield is an important criteria. You may know me from CNBC, where we talk about this stuff on TV. The ETF world has become a big part of what we talk about and what we have to talk about and what's driving markets. So, without further ado, let me quickly introduce the panel, and we'll get going. Jay Hatfield is the CIO of InfraCap. InfraCap has an MLP fund. They also have a preferred fund. Jay's been doing this and certainly been a big player in the energy space for a long time, both as a banker and obviously as the CIO of a firm that's dedicated to really focusing on yield products. Jeremy Held is the head of research at ALPS Portfolio Solutions, and Jeremy's no stranger to the ETF world, having been doing this for 20 years. He oversees their product development and certainly is someone that I think also can speak with great authority on yield products. Colin Ireland is the ETF strategist at State Street. Clearly, that title alone tells you that these guys are in the middle of some of the bigger names in this space, and Colin's gonna help us opine on how they advise and communicate to the market about where they see opportunities in high yield. And finally, Jeremy Mayer is the strategist at Global X, a new post for John, sorry, who has come over after being the strategist at Merrill Lynch, running their model portfolio, and a guy that the market knows pretty well in terms of what he's been doing. And again, someone who has had to spend a lot of time on asset allocation and discuss the merits of high yield, all within the context, I think, of really where the market is. And just from a housekeeping note, I think we'd like to keep this lively. We'd like to take questions. In fact, if you have questions as we go, I think that can work fine. Raise your hand and we'll call you out, because I think it's sometimes more interesting to get the questions if we're not making a point clear. We may keep moving too. But before we do that, guys, I think I'd like to at least frame where we are in the market right now. I'd like to frame, first of all, we're at a pretty interesting crossroads with macro, both in terms of the rates environment. The Fed last week raised. The Fed's out there today saying that they may not go this year, but they certainly may begin unwinding the balance sheet. We're all weighing that. Oil, we know what's going on in the oil market, and yet markets are at all-time highs. So it's a very interesting crossroads to be talking about yield products. And so let me start there, guys, and I'll start with you, Jay. As you think about investing in your world, how do you view the current macro setup?
Well, I guess the most important factor is your view on interest rates. And for most of this year, we've been relatively bullish on interest rates, which was more insightful earlier in the year than is probably now. But the part, first of all, I think it's important to look at most issues. Investing issues are multi-factor, whereas if you watch television, people like, not necessarily Tim, but Cramer and others, they are really kind of a one-factor model. They mention the one element that supports their view. So there, we see about six or seven key factors, but the one that I haven't heard anything about from other people, and we've been trying to publicize, is there's now $38 trillion in global pension assets.
Right.
About $26 trillion are in the United States, and there's at least another $5 trillion of sovereign wealth funds. And by the way, the pension funds are growing at about 4.5% per year. And that's driven by an aging population, and particularly in the U.S., this is totally unpublicized, relatively conservative funding. So forget Illinois, that's the outlier, but in California, Texas, New York, recently Pennsylvania, Connecticut, they've committed to funding not just current contribution, but the gap over 10 to 20 years. There's a lot of money going into pension funds. It's creating a very strong demand for both equities and bonds. And by the way, only 28% of their assets are allocated to bonds. So in any sell-off, they're going to both reallocate because bond prices are down, equities are up, and they might decide to allocate higher than 28. So we see a cap on rates, particularly the 30-year, about 3.5. Like I said, now we're so far below 3, that's not as insightful.
How about the downside? Because it tends to be now, suddenly, we went from this world where everyone said that rates were going to spike after the election. We had fiscal. We had all these dynamics in terms of policy. What's the bottom
here?
Well,
I mean, I guess as a trader, I would probably be more likely to be short treasuries than long them. I'm talking about 30-year. But I would point out, I don't believe this is going to happen, but if you did believe the Fed's dot plot, which shows 3% short-term rates in 19, and if you assume that we're correct about this pension demand and that long rates are going to be about 3, that means an inverted yield curve, which every single time the yield curve is inverted in the last 100 years, we've had a recession. So if you believe that the Fed's really going to do that, which I totally don't, then you would assume a recession and the 30-year could go to below 2.
I'm not sure the Fed believes their own dot plot. Jeremy, weigh in here as you think about the current rates environment, because that makes it's a big determinant on how you guys view products.
Yeah, I think even the question on rates is one of interpretation, because when people say rates, what do they mean? Do they talk about the short end of the curve, or are they talking about the 10-year? Because there's this notion that everyone believes that rates are going to go up, and you know they're going to go up just because the Fed says that they're going to continue to raise. But you know, you look at 4 years ago, after the end of the taper tantrum, the 10-year was at 3.05, and actually thinking rates were going to go up from that standpoint on the 10-year was not a good bet from that perspective. So I think it matters which rates you're talking about. And it shouldn't necessarily be, what are we going to do in a rising rate environment? I think the world needs to get used to, what are we going to do in a flat rate environment? What if the 10-year is range bound between 2.25 and 2.75 for 5 years? And we haven't talked about oil yet, but there's a lot of dynamics in the oil market that probably suggest a range bound between $40 and $50, $40 and $60. And you look at all the factors that lead to why the 10-year is sort of stuck in this, 2.25, 2.5 range. And you look at, very modest inflation. You look at very modest GDP growth. And so you have to figure out a scenario and a strategy that, okay, what if rates stay in that lower range, don't necessarily move up or move down? What if the curve flattens, to Jay's point? I mean, right. Clearly, the Fed's not going to go to 3 if, the medium and the long end of the curve is sub that. I think they're not going to do that intentionally. And so the question is, how do you position a portfolio, not necessarily for rising rates, but for flat rates? And that's really the point of what we're talking about today. And
that's why you'd be chasing yield at a time when really markets are really extremely extended and spreads are tight.
Right. And I think chasing is the right word. And I think that, probably the most important thing and maybe the biggest takeaway here is, what are you chasing and what's the risk? And Tim, you mentioned it, and there's a metric that we publish quite a bit, which is yield per unit of risk. And I think that far too many investors go out there and they sort all the different yield products by one metric, and they look at yield, and they sort of stop there. And that really is a disservice, and you have to look at, what risk are we taking, and are you compensated for that risk? And in some cases you are, and in some cases you're not. So I think that's the biggest thing.
And it's called chasing high yield, but you never want to be chasing anything, because that effectively implies you've missed it. And I think we're all setting up a scenario here or reminding the investors that people were doing a lot of chasing 6 months ago. So, Colin, what's State Street's house view on if you can boil it down, it's complicated what the world's doing right now, but tell us how you think about the next 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, I think the next 3 months are a little bit easier to forecast. I think, generally speaking, modest growth, better earnings. I think we probably err on the side of positive. Generally speaking, I think markets can kind of trend sideways for the most part over the next, until at least the fall. And I think once the fall rolls around, obviously we're going to have the Fed unwind, and we're going to see how the Fed reacts to that, how the Fed interprets core inflation, which I think the majority of us at State Street believe will continue to kind of underwhelm towards that 2% target. And then I think the main thing is, and the reason why the positivity is that you have this underlying sense of optimism alongside policy action. And in the case that you get debt finance tax reform, that could be the event that kind of spurs the higher rates that we've been talking about. And that's kind of what we're waiting for, I think. I think we're looking through the summer. We're trying to be as selective as possible. I think for the most part, it's consensus that if nothing else, the curve is going to flatten. And as the curve flattens and you do take on risk, to Jeremy's point, you have to be selective. Right. So we're looking to diversify out of traditional sources of yield, and we're looking for, new opportunities.
Great. And I think we'll dive into some of those in a little bit, Colin. So, John, it sounds like everybody's painted a picture of almost a sense of complacency and complacency, is not what these guys do in their daily jobs. They're not complacent at all, but there's this sense that we've gone from an over extreme in terms of rate expectations to one where now people think Fed's not going to hurt us. And the economy's, the porridge is just about right. Is that your view? Because it that should then, and maybe extrapolate from there. So how do you play that?
I mean, it's difficult because I agree with a lot of what everybody said. Inflation is pretty low. And what's going to drive inflation? Well, what's going to drive it lower, actually? If you look at the purchase of Amazon of Whole Foods, that is very disruptive to the to an $800 billion segment of the market. So groceries are about 15% of CPI, so that actually could be a deflationary aspect. There's other potential inflationary wage inflation, credit creation, but I believe that inflation is going to remain overall tame, so it's going to be difficult to raise rates meaningfully.
Even with a labor market that, because Philly Fed hacker out there talking about the Phillips curve again, which I'm not sure it's relevant. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. But the Fed sounds like it's not about if, it's about when, and when it happens faster than ever.
Well, then you just have flatter rates lately because the long end of the curve has gone down since the election. So if you bought treasuries in the beginning of the year, you'd be up 7%. So something that you'd buy something very safe and you'd be up 7% versus everything, the other things that we're trying to talk about here. But everything's a little expensive. So, you have quality dividends from equity stocks expensive, duration's expensive, credit expensive, is expensive. So you have to look at some non-traditional sources of income. Yep. Going forward.
Great. No, I think that seems to be a takeaway right now, and I think that's why this panel should be as in focus as any. It's an amazing cross currents. We have to, obviously, in the dividend high yielding ETF space, where MLPs make a big part of it, and also, let's face it, the deflationary aspects of oil on top of what's going on in the food space and the consumer staples space is another big part of what's giving the Fed a major sense of comfort, at least, that inflation could undershoot. Let's talk about oil, guys. Let's talk about, Jay, what has now, again, come to a place where we had this V-shaped recovery. Everybody thought OPEC was in control. Everybody thought that the U.S. Non-conventional was under control, and yet now we're at record production again.
Well, this is a particularly frustrating point because you do get the commentary every day from everybody on in the media.
You can say it.
Yeah.
I'm right here.
That's okay. In the media. But so again, there's a one factor model. But what the real way to, I think, to think about it, and I echo Jeremy's comments, is that if you hopefully you took high school economics or in college and you think down to the elasticity of demand and supply, so all that means is sensitivity. So how does that translate? So what that means is that, for instance, in the beginning part of this year, we were lapping gasoline prices that were substantially lower in the prior year. So the elasticity of demand for gasoline is 25%. So we had lower demand for gasoline, and everybody was surprised by that. But, of course, you shouldn't have been. Now we're actually lapping lower prices than we were last year because they had run up last year. Now we're running down and there's a lag. So we're probably going to hit July 4th with, in some parts of the country, gas prices below $2. And so...
Yeah, I mean, we're at the lowest in 12 years.
Yeah.
You've got driving season in the middle, and you've got 94% utilization.
Right. So that's going to be, and, you know, everybody, it's easy. I've traded energy for, you know, over 10 years and been in the sector for over 25, unfortunately. But I can tell you, every June, every September, energy's weak, and everybody's shocked by it. It's easy to short if you're a commodity trader, hedge fund trader. It's very easy to be short oil and long Amazon in June, and you're not going to get blown up by it. You might lose 30 cents one day. You can cover. And the only thing that's probably going to shake the shorts loose is getting into real driving season, which is post-July.
Right.
And those, by the way, totally unreported, everybody wants to talk about Permian production and what they don't understand about that. That's where the elasticity of supply comes in. God does not supply the capital for drilling wells. It comes from cash flow. And so when the prices are 40, companies drill less. This is not well understood by common people, definitely not the media. Doesn't matter if the IRRs are 30%. They're only going to spend what they have, and they're definitely not going to issue equity like they were earlier in the year because their stock prices are off 15%. So production will slowly decline, be flattish, not probably decline, whereas in the IEA models, they have the U.S. producing well over 10 million barrels. So there's going to be a supply response. This is just economics. And there's going to be a demand response. But there's already a demand response in distillate and in jet fuel, 6% year-over-year increase because economic activity is higher.
Right. But let's think about it. So I agree with that, although I would say that the markets are telling you, it's really the markets that are saying there's some sense that the Permian is a dynamic that's uncontrollable. Or that OPEC has lost control. And think about it, when Russia and Saudi Arabia have to be bedfellows, it tells you a lot about the strength of this cartel or lack thereof. Obviously, Russia outside of the cartel. But Saudi Aramco IPO is a dynamic that will change OPEC forever if it hasn't already been. And if you think about Russia's oil market, even though Russia is certainly run by one guy, their oil market is run by private oil companies, so you're going to have private oil companies now. So as you think about the next 9 months, Jeremy, because that, let's put it in the context for investing, because you know, if you look at what MLPs have done in the last 2 or 3 months, how do you think about from now till, say, the next OPEC meeting in March of 2018?
And the thing is, I mean, energy is not like every other sector. There's this visceral, emotional response to energy. It's such an important commodity. It's sort of the lifeblood of you know, a lot of what people do. And so when you look at what happened, whether it's vis-a-vis MLPs or it's E&P stocks or it's oil services, the world is having such a hard time coming to this realization, and it's becoming fact that OPEC doesn't matter. And, you know, oil's off 15% since the disappointing OPEC meeting on May 25th. And for whatever reason...
And was that disappointing? I mean, what else could they have done?
Right, exactly. And the reality is that for a cartel to be effective, you have to have consensus and control, which OPEC had for essentially 40 years, and they have neither right now. And the U.S. is the de facto swing producer in crude, and the sooner that investors recognize that, then they don't have to be so disappointed that OPEC isn't going to be able to impact prices. And in this sort of game of chicken at $40 crude, the U.S. is much better positioned from a technological perspective, from an oil as a percentage of GDP, from the fact that we're not using oil revenues to make transfer payments to our citizens. A lot of these Middle Eastern countries, these OPEC countries, they really need $60, $70, $80, in some cases $90 crude just to balance their budgets. So if we have $40 crude in the U.S., it's tough for Halliburton, it's tough for Schlumberger, it's tough for Oxy, it's tough for the city of Houston. The U.S. moves along, and so I think that you're going to see these dynamics in place where oil in the U.S. and the swing producers are going to be fine, but because it's such an emotional and visceral reaction, you see sentiment play a huge role, and Jay can confirm this too, and John on the MLP side, that so many investors came to us and said, I really wish we would have been able to buy MLPs last February and March because they were trading in lockstep with crude, and then all of a sudden they weren't. And we published this research that basically says, look, anything where crude's above $60, MLPs and crude are not correlated. Between 45 and 60, it's about 0.5, and the biggest determinant is where you are over the moving average.
Yeah.
South of 45, it's 0.95. I mean, really, since May 25th, you want to know what MLPs are doing, just look at what crude's doing.
Well, it actually looks like MLPs have underperformed in this last little leg. Yep, when, in fact, we're not. We haven't broken the key levels here for Brent or crude, depending on what you follow.
Right.
So, Colin, tell me how the sentiment's lining up for oil, therefore, in terms of what you guys are seeing in flows in your products at State Street, or impute that upon, again, you know, a house view.
Yeah. So, in addition to our yield products, we actually have a sector and industry suite that on the equity side has been extremely active in being used as a proxy for hedging. So we have an equal weight product that focuses on exploration and production, and that product has become a top 10 options market, and it's become a kind of a de facto hedging vehicle as a proxy for oil equities and potentially MLP exposure. So we actually look a lot at vol skew, implied volatility levels on some of our products, and we try to communicate that to sentiment in our high-yield products. So we have a credit-focused high-yield suite of two kind of flagship products. One is our longer-dated high-yield J&K, which tracks the Bloomberg Barclays U.S. High Yield Index, and then we have a shorter-term SJNK, which tracks the 0 to 5 end of the curve in high yield. And the first question we get whenever we talk about duration in high yield is that high yield doesn't react to changes in interest rates over short periods of time. And I would say we don't necessarily disagree, but what you accomplish by segmenting different segments of the high yield space is that you accomplish credit exposure differences based on the rules of the index. And we actually push a lot of our lower tier credit into SJNK. So you can actually play different spectrums of the high yield market using our products. So when in tying some of this together, what we look at a lot is we look at sentiment in the options market. We look at flows into and out of our sector products, which actually move a little bit quicker than our high yield flows.
Right.
Because of the creation and redemption process for the high-yield products. And we usually have a pretty good feel for which way flows are going to be directed. This week, you know, you don't have to be very insightful to know that flows are coming out of high-yield products, and sentiment has been relatively negative. But, I'd say, generally speaking, you know, the high-yield ETF space has become kind of a de facto, you know, product to speculate on oil as well.
Yeah.
So,
well, in fact, if it was 15 months ago, people were using the JNK as a proxy for understanding the oil market. I mean, effectively, we were looking at credit in this country, and it was imputed upon the banks. And I don't believe that price was truth back then, but clearly the high yield market was bearing the brunt of the oil market. And I guess so, John. We went from this V-shaped recovery to a place where realities of the oil market are settling in, as we've talked about them. But again, thinking about now as a guy that used to sit in front of $50 billion to allocate, you know, where is energy? Where is energy for you? Because one, you don't have to be in the space per se. I mean, you know, let's face it, a lot of people don't necessarily, in terms of its weighting the S&P, you can avoid energy and not get taken out, even if energy goes through the roof. But more importantly, I think sentiment has gotten so poor, and yet we've set up a scenario here where sideways is just fine. And so I'm curious how you would allocate that.
Sure. Let me just talk about my past life and my current life. My last job, I managed portfolios where we were exposed to every single sector, for the most part, really depending on which specific risk profile. So we likely never would completely exit a particular sector, but we would underweight a particular sector based on a certain risk profile or looking for a certain outcome.
Mm-hmm.
So we would be exposed to broad energy. We were underweight energy when I left a couple months ago. Currently, we do have an MLP product, and it was second to market. So that MLP product is a lot smaller than it's MLPA versus AMLP. AMLP was first to market. has about $9 or $10 billion. We have $500 or $600 million. Over the past 3 months, we've actually seen inflows, and we've seen inflows primarily because of tax law selling, tax harvesting, going from AMLP into MLPA. But my overall view is that you can't wish, you can't hope. Likely, you're going to have some allocation to energy, whether it be through MLPs. Right now, the correlation is a lot higher, so it is a lot closer to pure energy. But we go through cycles, and you're never going to catch it at the top. You're never going to catch it at the bottom. So you have to be invested, although you may have to. You may have a smaller allocation. It's easier for me to say it than for you to be in it. I'm on both sides of it, and it sometimes it's hard to hold on to something that's going down. But you don't know how long it's going to go down. Obviously, you can extrapolate in terms of what's going on in the market, but you have to stay in it. Although setting the allocation is a nuance of it.
Well, that's really important. So let's get into maybe some nuts and bolts of investments in yielding, high yielding, or income oriented ETFs, especially thinking about it from a horizon investment, and then a apples to oranges risks. So we've got a full range of products in here, but who wants to weigh in on where they see the best combination of risk reward in terms of an ETF asset class that either is so oversold in the MLP space that it's, if your horizon is X, or in the case of, utilities, which might have been, still haven't totally recovered from the pain of expectations of where interest rates were going, to EM debt, where, China's inclusion in the MSCI seems to be validation that things are not about to blow up over there, although that's probably debatable. But who likes what right now? And what space? And everyone can speak. So, Jay?
Well, to deal with the problem that John was just talking about with regard to MLPs, what we recommend investors do is really two things. And this can be if you're an advisor for your clients so you don't get a lot of blowback from your clients, is that we always recommend a smaller allocation to MLPs. So if you're in, if you think it's reasonable to have 10% utilities, then you'd have 4 or 5 in MLPs. If 5% is a normal allocation, then we would recommend 2 or 3 so that you get volatility that's closer to the market volatility. And we also recommend dollar cost averaging. Like right now, like about a year, we did a conference in February. We called MLPs the big long. I don't think they're probably quite the big long, but if you put money to work starting today over the next, say, 2 or 3 months, and then look back, wait a year, and then look back, you have a high probability that you made a good investment. So that's kind of the way we deal with the correlation to oil. As I mentioned before, the microeconomics argue that we're closer to the bottom of the range of oil, and we're not going to 20. It's kind of ironic that everybody makes that prediction just as we are hitting the support level.
That's not surprising.
So we're strongly bullish on MLPs. Our other ETF is PFFR. We recommended that in Barron's like 3 months ago. We think that's a great for long-term investors. I'm not sure that I would just go put my whole portfolio in PFFR with the 30-year, where it is right this moment in time. It's not super sensitive to interest rates, but if 30-year sells off by 60 basis points in the next month or two, it's not going to do particularly well. But that's a good preferreds. We think that investors, if you want yield, you should go for substantial yield, not be in the S&P that gets you 2%.
Right.
You should go for something with 5, 6.
Well, you'll probably 7%. Have different yield sleeves,
right?
And clearly, I think they both play out there.
Well, the preferreds do act like investment grade bonds, which are only yielding about 3, and that they will significantly outperform the market if we have a downturn. So they do stabilize the value portfolio. Just from a moment by moment tactical perspective, MLPs are sort of at the absolute bottom of the
range. Where do MLPs yield in a sideways oil market over the next year?
I think they'll probably tighten some. I mean, they're yielding the equal weighted indexes.
So oil doesn't do anything exciting, but the bottom doesn't fall out.
Right, because what's happened is that we already went from 100 to 20, and now we're just back, and we only went up to 55. So a lot of all the dislocations have been wrung out of the companies. They've reduced their dividends. They've sold equity. Their commodity exposure has been wrung out of their businesses just because it's not significant anymore. So, and they're going to report probably pretty solid, not spectacular earnings over the next couple months, and that's why they're going to go up. People are going to calm down. They're going to increase their distributions. June is not even normally a good time for the equity market. It just happens to be okay because of global recovery and some other factors. So we're relatively bullish on MLPs.
I think the key, too, is that for MLPs to recover, oil doesn't have to go up. Oil just has to stop going down. And Tim mentioned a great point earlier about spreads. If you want to see where MLPs are going to go, look at credit default swap spreads on energy. And once oil stops its free fall and actually stabilizes, you don't even need oil to go back to 50. If oil just stabilizes, that's exactly what happened last year. You saw MLPs are off 30% in the first 6 weeks. Oil's in free fall. Oil stops going down every day, and all of a sudden credit default swap spreads come in, and you see MLPs recovering. So I think we would agree with Jay, too. It's all about compensated risk. And if you look at all the different alternative yield strategies that are out there, from EM debt to preferreds to MLPs to high dividend stocks to CMBS to REITs to utilities, where are you being compensated for risk the most right now? And whether it's the shale revolution and all of the microeconomic dynamics setting up for crude and the fact they're massively oversold, MLPs are probably positioned the best, but you have to have a medium to long-term time horizon. You probably have to have a moderate to above-moderate risk tolerance. But of all those compensated risks, MLPs look pretty good. But the big issue, too, is where are you sourcing this allocation from? And we get this question all the time. We say, okay, if I'm going to allocate to preferreds, or I'm going to allocate to CMBS or to MLPs or to EM debt, do I take that from bonds or take that from stocks? And you have to look at, these are alternative income sources, but not necessarily alternative fixed income. If you source MLPs from your fixed income allocation, you're going to increase
the vol. You're changing your risk profile.
Yeah, the vol of the portfolio goes up. So certain of these alternative yield classes, you really want to source from equity, whether it's, you know, local currency EM debt and MLPs. If you're looking at, you know, reinsurance or private debt or maybe preferreds, then or CMBS, maybe you can source that from the income side of the equation. But be thinking about, okay, if I'm getting compensated and I like the asset class, then the next decision is, where do I source this from? And am I okay changing the overall vol of the portfolio, or should I source it from something on the equity side?
Okay, so Colin, you know, we tried to steer away from high yield debt when we get out of here, but let's talk about some alternatives in a very tight spread environment. And one where at least we set up a scenario where we think rates may be range bound. So getting into structured loans, getting into the credit stack. What do you guys like?
Yeah. So again, we're relatively positive. So it's not unrealistic that the
Sorry, it's the first time Siri's actually ever said anything useful. She said she didn't understand what Colin said, which is totally wrong.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So, you know, high yield in general, we're not overly bearish on the area as far as broadly. What I would say is, obviously, with spreads as tight as they are, we are looking away from the area. So, you know, a stat came out yesterday that 50% of CCC are trading above par versus under 10% last year when oil sold off as well. So that stat alone, I think, kind of says it all, that, you know, spreads are ultimately very tight. Volatility is extremely low. We're just looking for other alternatives. We think there's better opportunities out there. And one of those spaces is leveraged loans. With leveraged loans, it's new issuance is actually at an all-time near all-time lows, so it's also a very hot market. But what we like about leveraged loans in general is, number one, during periods of widening credit spreads, they outperform high yield on a relative basis. They traditionally have lower volatility, and in a rising rate environment, they're going to reset traditionally quarterly, monthly, or quarterly alongside LIBOR rates. So you have a kind of a duration hedge built into that product as well. So on a relative basis from high yield, you know, there's attractive opportunities within the leveraged loan space. Now, 70% of senior loans are trading above par right now. What does that mean? You have to be very selective. You can't necessarily go out and just buy leveraged loans broadly. And one of the things that we've done, being that Spider is not experienced in the senior loan space, is we actually partnered with GSO Blackstone, and GSO sub-advises our senior loan product, SRLN. And one of the benefits of active management, I think, most clearly is active credit selection. So you have a manager out there that can selectively choose credits in a very hot environment, as opposed to a passive benchmark that's going out and kind of buying the hottest issue.
And in fact, if we get this credit spike, that's exactly where you can be. You can have the alacrity to kind of move around.
Right, and you have portfolio management flexibility. You have a manager that can kind of avoid problematic areas such as energy. Energy is actually under 0.5% allocation versus 10% plus in the high yield products.
Yeah, it makes sense. John, take us home. We've got about 8 minutes left on this panel, and hopefully a question or two. But please, you know, we've summed up well. Equity markets, S&P is 20% expensive to its all-time highs. NASDAQ stratospheric, spreads are tight. Oil market looks dicey, and sideways is the best we can hope for. Not necessarily, but where are you?
You know, at Global X, we have a lot of dividend-oriented products. We have dividend-based products that are just high dividends. It really depends on the type of client you're looking for, what the client is looking for. Some are just looking for the highest possible yield without giving much regard to anything else. So we do have some of those products. We have dividend-based products that have a lot of REITs in them. Yielding 6 or 7%, not too bad. But again, if you bought Treasuries, you would have been just as you would have had the same return
with a lot. And REITs are far from a sure thing here.
What's that?
REITs are far from a sure thing here. Maybe very late in the commercial real estate cycle. We know what's going on in retail.
Yeah, so. I mean, it really depends on whether they're international or U.S. and where you know what the REITs own, but. Rising rates doesn't necessarily help REITs, but there is some potential options for increasing rents. But obviously with retail, depending on what they own, it could go the other way. One area that I actually think makes sense is preferreds, more of a kind of a market-weighted exposure within your fixed income bucket, which wouldn't give you an oversized exposure to preferreds. But to really be protected, fixed to floating rate preferreds would be a good area, which would reduce your interest rate risk meaningfully. And there was a large amount of issuance by banks of fixed to floating. We have one ETF, SPFF, which only has about 16% of fixed to floating, but has the ability to increase that. I just joined 2 weeks ago, so maybe that'll be one of my recommendations to our executive committee.
Great. And again, to bang on the point here is pick your yield or your income relative to your risk and where it's coming from in your portfolio, as Jeremy pointed out, and where your time horizon suits that. So if we're making a call on MLPs, we're not trading this. We're not trading it actively. Any questions from the audience right now? Because I haven't left a lot of time. This is a gentleman right here. I think there's a microphone coming your way.
Just a question for Jay and Jeremy. You both mentioned the flattening of the yield curve. And Jay, you also spoke about having a one-factor model when you talk about things. It seems that when you mention it, you are referring, of course, to the Fed's policy that the rates will not go up as fast. But meanwhile, rate is a multi-factor model. The economy, Colin said, there's moderate growth, earnings are good. Why is the yield curve flattening? It should be moderately steepening.
Well, actually, if you went empirically, I would assert that probably or 50% of the time when the Fed tightens, that it does flatten because it's lowering inflationary expectations. And so that's, again, what retail investors, they don't really distinguish between short and long-term rates. So if they hear the Fed rates are going up, they think there's 100% chance the 10-year and 30-year is going up. Where, again, I haven't done the regression, but it's probably 55% of the time the 30-year actually rate drops because of inflationary expectations, and 45% it goes up, depending on exactly what's going on with the macroeconomy and inflationary expectations. So that is the subtlety that I think at least a year ago, 90% of retail investors didn't get, and they panicked and sold all their yield product. But now they seem to have calmed down because yield product is trading fine.
And I think you have to think about, you know, there's a comfort that investors have with a nice steep yield curve, and that when the Fed increases rates, then the long end is supposed to respond in kind. And I think there has to be a catalyst, and Colin mentioned this too. You know, is it because we get tax reform? Is it because inflation, there's sort of this euphoria around inflation finally hitting 2% like it did for a month. That's still not massive inflation. You've seen unemployment go to 4.3, but you haven't really seen wage growth yet. So you're going to need to see some kind of catalyst. And the Fed can do what they want to do. And the Fed could keep, they could raise every 6 weeks for the next 2 years. Unless you see a catalyst in the market, like inflation actually getting north of 2, 2.25, seeing wage growth, maybe it's a commodity reflation that comes back off if energy prices come back. There has to be some type of catalyst for rates to go up, other than investors would like rates to go up or they're expecting rates to go up. And so I think, instead of asking the question, you know, why haven't they gone up, I think the question should be, what is the catalyst that would cause them to go up? And I think you're seeing that, to Jay's point, there's this flattening, because if there isn't a catalyst in the long end of the curve, and the Fed, through, you know, just because they, you know, they figure they have to do it, keeps raising the short end, you're going to see this natural flattening. And then there's sort of the expectation gap too, that people expect that the long end is going to go up and it doesn't, so they figure, okay, the policy isn't working. And that caused them to sell the long end of the curve.
Well, in the last couple of minutes, I mean, not only that, but we get back to what Jay said, which is one of the reasons why rates aren't going higher is because there's a ton of money chasing that part of the curve. And think about it globally. Think about where rates are. Think where the 10-year bund is. And think what's going on in Europe. I mean, Europe's economy, do you want to be long rates in Europe, which has got the best economy in the world? PMIs are at 8-year highs. You've got employment. You've got labor markets in Spain and France, which are strong as they've ever been. So I think, again, we didn't spend a lot of time talking internationally, which we could all probably do for days. I think that's another driver. I mean, think about the synchronized global kind of economy, which at least on the flip side was the reason why the Fed wasn't going in the past. So in other words, we looked to China, we looked to Europe, and we said, actually, these were impediments to the Fed. And then the other thought in closing is also that the Fed is going now because they can. The Fed, a year ago, the markets did not let them. And what's extraordinary is that we've had 4 rate hikes in the last 18 months, after doing nothing for 10 years. But we all know what happened after the first rate hike. So the Fed, on some level, has done a phenomenal job of massaging this. Maybe they don't deserve that credit. But the bottom line here is, I think, you know, to sum up the panel, there's extraordinary opportunities in ETFs that bring you higher yielding exposure to different asset classes, and that it's very important to understand and have a baseline, take your view on where rates are, where oil is, where the markets are, because you can't make these decisions in a bubble. You can't make them in a vacuum. And I know this is obvious, except for the fact that people want to jam a product out there, and these guys were so understated about that. I mean, what's good about this panel is no one really needed to tell you why their product's the one, even though these guys all run phenomenal businesses. So I think that's, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank my panelists here for a great job in the chasing high yield panel today. Thank you.